House Committee on Revenue for April 19, 2017 will come to order. Colleagues, thank you so much for your attendance today. Because of the attendance of our esteemed colleagues, we're going to start with the public hearing on House Bill 2864. I'm sorry, 2964. Thank you, 2964. Give us the short version, and then we'll hear from the members.
Okay, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2964 is a measure that would modify an existing permissive property tax exemption to allow existing qualified dwelling units that are newly purchased or rehabilitated to qualify for property tax exemption. This would be up to 10 successive property tax years. So the existing underlying property tax exemption is for newly constructed properties that meet the requirements in statute, including value no greater than 120% of median sales price of the dwelling unit. And again, this is a permissive property tax exemption available to cities. They then need other districts to come on board to provide the exemption outside of just the city district's taxing revenue. So it's just an expansion to an existing tax expenditure.
It's a property tax expenditure.
It is a property tax expenditure. Yes, I should have started off with that.
Start with that.
And
thank
it,
you.
I should note it only is effective going forward.
Right. Good. Please.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Vince, and committee. My name is Chuck Thompson. I represent Senate District 26, and I'm here today to talk about House Bill 2964, which would provide cities with additional tools to promote access and retention of affordable home ownership. With the housing crisis in Oregon, it is more important than ever to promote home ownership for low and moderate income households. This is an important issue in my district, which includes portions of Southeast Portland. House Bill 2964 allows Portland to build on a program it has been successfully implementing to provide low and moderate income households with a limited tax exemption when purchasing a newly constructed affordable single unit home. This bill allows the city to provide a limited tax exemption on the value of a dwelling, not the land, to a qualifying low or moderate income buyer of an existing affordable home, or to the low income owner of a home that also receives publicly funded home repair rehabilitation investments for projects like fixing a leaky roof or some broken windows. Thanks for your consideration for this legislation, and I encourage you to please move House Bill 2964 forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, colleagues, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Benz, and myself. For the record, my name is Barbara Smith Warner, State Representative from House District 45, Northeast Portland, and Maywood Park and Park Rose. I don't have too much to add to what Senator Thompson so eloquently put it. Just so you know, this bill does come from the House Committee on Human Services and Housing, where it was passed with a 9-0 do-pass recommendation. I had the privilege of introducing this bill before that committee as well. And as Senator Thompson mentioned, this is one of those let's get every tool in the toolbox to help deal with our housing crisis. And it's one of those things where this is already working with newly constructed. Why not expand it and make it eligible for already constructed houses as well? And just so you know, Portland does implement this program through an agreement with Multnomah County. And these changes specifically will provide additional local options for promoting affordable access and stability in home ownership. So I would ask you to please give this every consideration and give it a due pass recommendation and continue to move it in the process.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. We also have two representatives of the City of Portland to testify.
And if I may indulge myself, hello, Andrea.
Hello.
The last time I was able to introduce this, Andrea and I happened to go to the same gym in Portland, and so I had the happy coincidence of discovering when she came and testified before the Housing Committee that she was on just after me, so I thought I would entertain my legislator privilege to sit at the table and encourage their testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Smith-Warner. Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Mathiason with the Portland Housing Bureau. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today in support of House Bill 2964. As has been mentioned, ORS 307 currently allows local jurisdictions to create a program that allows low and moderate income home buyers to get a 10-year property tax exemption when they are purchasing new construction units. Those need to be approved prior to their completion in order to qualify per the statute. Under the current statute, homes must sell for under 120% of the county median sales price. Additionally, local jurisdictions may impose more restrictive requirements in terms of sales price cap, bedroom size, geography, things of that nature. And also, as has been mentioned, local jurisdictions can must approve the creation of these programs in partnership with other taxing jurisdictions. Portland has been administering its current 10-year property tax exemption program for single-family units in its current form since 2012. Multnomah County, representing 51% of local taxing jurisdictions, approved that program in partnership with the City of Portland. We elected to further restrict the both the MFI of the home buyer and the sales price. Median family income, also known as AMI, area median income. Current statute allows for the units to be sold up to 120% of the county median sales price. Portland uses 120% of the county median sales price, and that's currently $350,000. The median family income of the home buyers that we approve for those purchases is at 100% of area median income, as opposed to some of the higher thresholds that may be available. Portland conducts ongoing robust compliance on these units to ensure that the intended beneficiaries, the property owners, are actually the ones that continue to receive the benefit long term. The units are not allowed to be rented out, so we conduct quarterly compliance auditing of those. The current program provides an exemption of an annual estimated benefit of about $2,000. As has been mentioned, the exemption is provided on the structure, not the land. And so that translates in very approximate dollars to about $150 a month for the current program on new construction units. The matrix on the screen in front of you shows a couple of different points that I wanted to call your attention to very briefly. Our program in Portland is capped at 100 units annually, which was fine several years ago, but as the real estate market in Portland has escalated, we no longer see the programmatic utilization that we have historically. Also, the average sales price of the units that are being built under this program has increased pretty significantly, and not necessarily at the same pace as household incomes in Portland. So we're seeing a disconnect between local household income and the homes that are being built under the current statute. So households are less able to afford what is being newly constructed for homeownership units in Portland. An expansion of House Bill 2964 would benefit Portland as well as other jurisdictions across the state, simply because it would expand the available units that would be potentially approved under this program. In Portland, we see just builders less and less frequently building at the price points that are, as I said earlier, affordable to the low-income home buyers. In addition to home ownership, this is a valuable statutory opportunity to provide a tax exemption to help stabilize existing low-income home buyers, particularly in Portland, as displacement is occurring, gentrification is happening. Property tax exemptions are one tool that we have locally that might be able to help stabilize low-income homeowners. In addition to those elements, the proposed would include the current requirements for local jurisdictions to approve those in partnership with counties, 51% of the taxing jurisdictions, and provide the ability for further restrictions to be imposed. I think at this point, I just wanted to say thank you very much for the opportunity to provide this information. Ask if you had any questions at all about the way Portland administers its current program.
I think we'll take the rest of the testimony and then we'll go to questions.
Okay. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, Dan Eisenbeis with the City of Portland. And I think I am here today mostly to serve as a hopefully capable technical assistant and help respond to questions. Thank you.
Right. Questions for this panel? Yes. Representative Marsh, please.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just curious, what is 100% of the median income, family median income in Portland?
Currently, it's about $74,000 per household annually for a household of four. And that's calculated based on household size.
It's median.
So the requirement would be, subsequent question, that you have to be under $74,000 to qualify for the program?
Correct. I believe that's 100% of median family income for a household of four.
Okay. I think it might be useful. We have several new members on the committee this year. It might be useful if you would take a minute to talk about what the sideboards are on the current program involving new construction so that the committee can understand that this is fairly well protected from events that might evade the intent of the law.
So this program under the current statute has been administered in Portland for decades. The current version of the program administered since 2012 imposed bedroom size types of requirements and further fleshed out the ongoing auditing requirements of the program to ensure that if a developer builds a property, they are not allowed to rent the property. So they are given specific periods of time from which they apply to the period of time, which typically in Portland, it's 12 months from the approval of the application to the point at which they must sell the property. And so if it goes beyond that, there's a very serious conversation that happens about complications. Was permitting process taking a while, or you know what those factors might be? So the developers building the units are not the intended recipient of the tax exemption. And the tax exemption actually only kicks in once a significant portion of the construction has taken place, because it's on the structure and not the land. If they are sitting on the land, there's no property tax exemption provided under this program.
And under construction, property is assessed at a lower value than completed construction.
Mm-hmm.
What I was thinking about were other sideboards. What happens if the owner who qualifies for the exemption because of their income or whatever the other requirements are decides to sell the property? What happens then?
So Portland has administered this program in a number of different ways. Currently, we do not check the income of the subsequent home buyers, as we refer to them. It's the initial home buyer that income qualifies. In the past, we have actually, every time there's been a change in title, we have checked the income of the applicant to ensure that they had incomes below the requirements at that time. So that type of programmatic requirement would be up to kind of local control based on the statute.
Under the current statute, right. What that means, I think, is that if the initial buyer decided after 5 years to sell the property, the subsequent buyer would get the benefit of the other 5 years of exemption. Would that be correct?
That would be correct. I think I would want to add that we did an analysis of the program in Portland, and 87% of our buyers stay for the full 10 years of the exemption. In Portland, particularly, people are not selling their units because there's nowhere in their own community that they can afford to move. But that that subsequent home buyer income verification is fully allowed under the statute. It would be up to local jurisdictions.
Mm-hmm. Does the bill require anything about the condition of the not newly constructed properties that might come into this program? I mean, does somebody need to bring them up to some kind of quality or usability?
There's flexibility in the proposal in terms of defining publicly funded rehabs. I can imagine that some jurisdictions would want to impose those thresholds. In Portland, currently, we are funding emergency home repairs, kind of rehabilitation that's necessary to help people both maintain the integrity of the structure, roofs, for example, but also to protect the health and safety of the occupant.
Very good. Other questions? Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that. So the bill talks about newly purchased or rehabilitated properties. Would it also apply to expansion of existing properties, i.e. someone, they're outgrowing their existing home, they can't afford to go purchase it in another location, but they want to add a second story onto their home. Would it apply to that as well?
You know, I think that's a great question, and I would also just defer to local jurisdictions to formulate a program that responds to their community's needs.
That currently doesn't apply in Portland, is that correct? You're not doing it in Portland, I guess, is my question.
We are not currently, we don't have the authority to provide a tax exemption for rehabilitation. In Portland, if this bill passes, we would create a program in partnership with our local taxing jurisdictions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, if I might add, Portland's intent with this proposal regarding rehabilitation of existing homes is really to address deficiencies in terms of public health and safety, things like repairing a leaky roof or a broken window, not to remodel somebody's home with nicer amenities.
To your knowledge, is anyone else other than the City of Portland using this mechanism?
I am not aware of a jurisdiction in Oregon that utilizes this statute.
All right. The statute isn't restrictive, however, is it? I mean, Eugene could use it, or Paisley, or anybody.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, the statute, the authorization is available to cities throughout the state, and for that reason, we appreciate that the statutory framework is somewhat flexible in allowing a local city to design a program that meets their local needs.
What districts constitute the 51% approval in Portland?
In Portland, it's the City of Portland and Multnomah County.
And they together equal 51% of the property tax levied.
That's correct.
In the city. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2964 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3443. Back again.
I can greet myself again.
Madison, give us the short version.
Chair, the short version of this bill is, or the bottle bill.
Thank you.
It's very short. Appreciate that.
Well, this allows actually for the OLCC, who today is the entity that collects the information about redemptions and redemption rates and so on, to start compiling those different rates and redemptions and publish them on the website in order for those to happen. I think the bill asks for certain previous privacy or restrictions to be moved out of the law, so that would allow for distributors and redemption centers to have all these information available.
Very good.
Great.
Hello again.
Hello, colleagues. So nice to see you. Still. Once again, for the record, my name is Barbara Smith Warner, House District 45, Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. As we well know, the bottle bill is a historic piece of legislation and is truly a part of Oregon's identity as a state. It reduces litter, it's good for our environment, and it provides alternative income methods for many people that need that. As it stands, my bill, House Bill 3443, that I come before you with today, is another step in my work in this committee for increased transparency. By opening the books of this quasi-governmental system to ensure that this voluntary tax, as I have heard it called, is being used the most responsibly. The Oregon Bottle Bill program has an unusual, as I mentioned, quasi-governmental structure, as it's legislatively regulated, industry-run, and consumer-funded. This has allowed for a large amount of innovation to occur, alongside coordination and general oversight from the state. The Oregon Bottle Bill system, however, is not funded by the industry directly. Rather, it is funded by Oregon consumers with the deposits from the unredeemed deposits of beverage containers. So just to walk through the process briefly, for those of you who aren't on energy and environment and haven't heard this a number of times before. So it's designated in statute that when a beverage distributor delivers their product to a grocery store or a retailer, the retailer pays for those beverages and a deposit per container. So the dime now moves from, the dime now goes from the grocery store to the distributors. Then you and I go to the store and we buy the product. We as consumers pay that dime to the grocery store. So the grocery store has now been paid back that dime that they paid to the distributor. The consumer, who now has the bottle or can in their possession, they have the option to either redeem those containers and get that deposit back per container, or to leave their dime unclaimed by recycling or otherwise disposing, but we hope recycling, of the container through a non-redemption method. In the case of these unredeemed containers, the deposit that has been paid by Oregon consumers is retained by the beverage distributors. So as the management of the bottle bill is assigned in law to the distributors, many distributors utilize these unclaimed bottle deposits to defray the costs of managing the transportation and facilities required to run the implementation of the bottle bill. And indeed, this is the funding source for the Oregon Beverage Recycling Commission, Council, cooperative, thank you. I'm really bad at C's as initials because there's so many things they can stand for. And you will hear from them today with a lot of information about how they run the system, I would assume. What we don't know, however, is how much this system costs. OBRC has testified extensively on the costs of establishing and running their bottle return centers, but we don't know what the full budget is or the dollar amount that indeed funds the system. In 2012, House Bill 1508 included a section that specifically limited bottle bill transparency in the annual beverage container return data report. So House Bill 1508 said in statute it restricted the OLCC's annual bottle bill report that they already do. They already are doing this every year. It restricted them from being able to include the redemption rate just as a percentage. The raw numbers of the containers, both redeemed and unredeemed, were expressly prohibited from the report. So they were expressly prohibited from doing the raw numbers, just reporting the percentage. And it's divided by can, bottle, aluminum, plastic, glass, etc. So this 2012 legislation made it highly difficult to know how much money paid by Oregonians was retained by the beverage distributors and how much of that money is spent by the system because the system that exists because of a legislatively imposed program and how much is left as profit. In 2013, a bill requiring a report on redemption centers passed, and that required the total numbers of containers returned each year to be reported to the legislature every odd-numbered year. The numbers have been made public for 2014 and 2015 as of March 1st, and that is an important step forward for transparency. So now we can indeed, with some math that I haven't had to do since I helped my eighth grader before I stopped helping my eighth grader, we can calculate the beverage, those exact numbers. And indeed, I'm trying to decide if I'm actually going to submit this for the record or not, but I think I will. So these are numbers because it sounded so. Calculating from that public report that beverage distributors had about $30 million in unredeemed deposits in 2015. Now, I double-checked that because that sounded insanely high to me. The number that you start with, because the idea is that the redemption rate of 64.5% of 1 billion containers. So then you have to go up. So if that's 64%, what's 100%? So what's the total amount? That's $1.6 billion. So that means that 35.5% unredeemed is 583 million unredeemed containers, which if you multiply that by 5 cents, is indeed $29.19 million. Now, to be clear, that doesn't address, so those numbers are still not easily accessible to the public. It still takes a bit of work. It's not easily accessible on a yearly basis or in a report that's appropriately named or easy to identify. And to be fair, it does nothing to account for the real costs that the OBRC has for the redemption system. Indeed, we know because they've talked about in bits and pieces, it takes this much per year to run run a center once it's built. And it takes this much to build a center. But we have no sense of what that overall cost is. So does it cost $30 million a year, or did it cost $30 million in that year? I don't know, and we don't really have a way that we can know. And that also doesn't address the fact that there is also revenue that comes into the co-op from recycling that glass and that plastic and that aluminum. So the bill before you, House Bill 3443, would require that a real total number of beverage containers purchased and redeemed to be included in that OLCC beverage container return data report. Along with the percentages that are already reported, this additional data would allow for any interested Oregonian to easily calculate the amount of funds retained by the distributors on a yearly basis. This report would require no new calculations or extra work for the OLCC because one assumes they have those numbers already to get to the percentage. It would just offer further aggregate information that they already have on hand to be shared with an interested public. And this would give us a realistic place to start a conversation about our system. The bottle bill is a valuable program, as I've mentioned, both environmentally and socially. It's also a monopoly. Increased transparency would allow for Oregonians to know the path of their deposit and provide an opportunity for the legislature to look at opportunities to increase financial efficiency and responsibility. Ultimately, I want to gather this information because I want to be sure that the bottle bill, which is a legislatively mandated system, is not subsidizing the distributors with excess revenue. In any time, but especially in a time of budget shortfall, this is neither fiscally nor morally responsible. We need more information. 7 other states across the country have all or part of the unredeemed deposits from their bottle bill redemption systems returned to the state. Michigan, for example, has a 94% redemption rate, and it gives part to retailers and part designated towards environmental funds. In 2009, Connecticut required distributors to disclose their income from deposits and to return the unredeemed deposit revenue stream to their general fund. My hope is that with this information, we can use this public money to develop a dedicated funding stream to provide key services to Oregonians. Who on this committee has had constituent, or I should say, who hasn't had constituents in their offices calling or emailing about an essential program to their family that is underfunded or being cut? I know I have, more times than I can count. This bill has a lot of possibility, and honestly, it's likely to shift and grow a little bit potentially over the next few weeks. I'm open to developing amendments that could consolidate the 2 reports required from the OLCC and therefore reduce their workload, improve reporting. Further, I'm considering ways to best expand the appropriate level of financial transparency required from the distributors in the OBRC. As my colleague from the Milwaukee area, Representative Karin Power, here represented on my right, will share, I am also concerned with the accessibility of the growing bottle drop system for people who are low income, working multiple jobs, or experiencing homelessness. I hope that we can work to address these issues in further versions of this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer your questions.
Thank you, yep. Representative Power.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, I am State Representative Karin Power from House District 41, representing Southeast Portland, Milwaukee, and Oak Grove. The bottle bill is one of Oregon's greatest environmental achievements, and there have been several hearings this year on aspects of the program and the process of returning recyclable bottles and cans. I'm here alongside Representative Smith Warner to discuss House Bill 3443 amid some larger questions about that process. In the House Committee on Energy and the Environment this session, we heard another bill regarding the convenience of access to the Oregon Beverage Recycling Cooperative's bottle drop facilities. During that public hearing, I learned that in some circumstances, OBRC that manages bottle drop redemption centers requires an individual's driver's license or state ID and address in order to participate. I also learned that centers are only open from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. each day, which may not be convenient for those who work multiple jobs or those with commitments during regular business hours.
While the bill did not move forward this session, I have lingering questions about accessibility, equity, and data security and records retention policies of these cooperatives, and look forward to continuing to engage in these discussions with stakeholders. Currently, the OLCC is required to calculate the previous calendar year's percentage of beverage containers returned for each distributor cooperative and each distributor or importer that does not participate in a cooperative by categories in metal, glass, and plastic. When reporting requirements were added to the beverage container return program, they were limited, and this has resulted in data that requires additional calculations to determine revenue for distributors. Plainly, this means that the public does not know how much money is being made off of Oregon's bottled deposit program. With the changes to the bottle bill over time, consolidation of redemption centers in urban areas has occurred, and many are now managed via a cooperative. For the sake of public transparency, the state should require OLCC to report additional data that reveals the amount of money that these entities are receiving from Oregonians' unclaimed bottle deposits. House Bill 3443 is a starting point for answering questions about the program, making sure that there are no nickels or dimes related to the program that the public would rather be using for other purposes, and an opportunity to evaluate if the program is using best practices to be accessible and convenient for all to use. By tightening up reporting requirements, we build transparency and accountability. Thank you, colleagues, for working on this.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Yeah, Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. Thank you both. So Representative Smith-Warner, this bill is really, at this point, only about disclosure of information. You talked about some other potential developments that could happen once the information is available, but at this point in time, the bill is only about the disclosure of the actual numbers of containers sold and redeemed. Is that correct?
That is correct. Just in the time since it was introduced, I've had both reports back from some E&E hearings and some outreach from Representative Power and other folks about the opportunity to have further to utilize it for further conversations about equity and going forward.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Representative Cardenas, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for this interesting bill. I also ran some numbers because I've been convinced for quite a while that the bottle bill was being incorrectly used as a recycling device for things far beyond bottles. And of course, that's exactly what's going to happen with things. So your inquiry is welcome. It's a little late in the sense that somehow we jumped from a nickel to a dime without much discussion about why we went up a nickel. That just seemed to be like a nice round number. And so here we are, perhaps your bill, debating what we might do with the excess amount caught up in that new nickel. And I don't remember this degree of questioning back when I was busy voting no on the expansion of the suggested one to a dime. Are you concerned that someone might suggest that we ask for the dime just in anticipation of doing what you're now actually doing?
Interesting. Thank you for the question, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Bentz. Couple things. First of all, I was not in the legislature when the expansion was voted upon, when that deal was struck, such as it ended up being. I would argue, however, that if a primary motivation for the system is to decrease trash, increase, you know, return rates, indeed, a nickel in 1972, 1973, 1976, that when we first passed this, that was a significant motivator. It was a significant financial motivator for folks to get involved and stay involved in this system. And so that in and of itself, I believe, was a much higher motivating amount than it is now. I would agree that indeed, I think a lot of the explanation for the decrease in redemption rates can be explained by the fact that a nickel in 2015 ain't what a nickel was in 1975, and far from it. And so I would agree that if your goal is to keep the redemption rates up, I believe that it was I believe in that policy argument, period, that is a good policy to do, that indeed if you want to get your redemption rates back up in a time when people can easily curbside recycle and throw in a nickel away every time doesn't seem like very much money, then that's how you do it, is you indeed raise it to this 10 cents. I would argue, I have... Ever since I learned that the nickel, I had to adjust, and anytime I talk to people about this, they assume that the state gets that unredeemed nickel. almost, you know, again, who knows what knowledge level different people have, but I'm sure if any of you have ever, trust me, do a survey at the next time you're at Fred Meyer, and people will think that extra, any unredeemed money doesn't, you know, goes to the state, goes for some source. And so I would argue that because we are doing, it has now doubled. Now, number one, you'll hear from OBRC that it has been successful in a lot of ways in that the return rate has jumped, I believe, to over 90%, which I think is great. I want that return rate to be high because if we are going to do this system this way, I want it to work. However, even a dramatically reduced rate of unreclaimed deposits, that, you know, they're going to be bigger. And to me, it's a good opportunity to take to retake a look at how this system is structured, and whether indeed we can and should. I would argue that the dollar amount is probably going to be lower if the return rates stay up, even at, you know, even down into the 80s, you're still going to be, because what are we were below 60% return rate 2 years in a row that triggered that. I'm wandering around a lot here. I'm trying to decide if I've answered your question or not. And I would say no. I don't think. I mean, that certainly wasn't my motivation.
You've answered.
Right. Okay. Good. Because I'm sure you have another one.
Another question. Really?
More or less.
Yeah. Okay. Our brains were talking to each other, even if our words weren't.
Okay. All right. Just checking.
Well, I don't know what to call this, whether it's a threat, if you don't return the can, we're going to take all your money, or whether it's a tax. But it seems like if we begin as the state to take the money, it starts to look a lot more like a tax than about anything else I can think of. Are you suggesting that I don't know what the ultimate goal of your bill is, because currently it's just asking questions,
right?
But if it ultimately is to, as I think you've been saying several times, that you want that money to go to the state, then I'd hate to use labels that you don't want to put on your bill, but is that what you're looking for ultimately, that we would change the part that's not needed by the recycling groups into a tax? Is that what that's going to be?
I think we could have a lot of definitional conversations. What I liked about some of the other states structured that I thought made a lot of sense was the idea that, for example, it's a 10-cent deposit, and of that, the combination of unredeemed, five cent, half goes to the distributor, half goes back to the state. Or some of them, the unredeemed is designated somewhere, but the recyclers or the redemption folks get a handling fee for each of the things. I'm just arguing, and I'm happy to call it a tax, because did I mention that I represent Northeast Portland? So I am indeed happy to call it a tax, because I have constituents every day asking me, why aren't we having a sales tax? Why don't we, you know, without exaggeration. And so I would say, if we need to call it a tax, I'm happy to have that conversation with you. I believe that because this is money that is being imposed upon people now by legislative intent, I would argue that, again, someone called it a voluntary tax when you don't return that. Because you have the ability to get that money back, that deposit back, simply by returning that, I would argue that if you want to call it a tax, it indeed would be a voluntary tax. And I would argue that because the state is imposing it, I believe it is worthwhile for the state, for its citizens, to get some utility out of that unreclaimed, that unclaimed money.
Last question.
Yes, please.
I also ran the numbers on the recycling part. I was able to get from the OLCC the 2015 redemption and sale numbers, and the sales, this was the nickel, were around 900 million, and the redemptions were 637 million, and these were cans. And so I ran the number on that, and the value of the aluminum inside those numbers, as on the day's aluminum prices, if you figure about 50% is what you get on recycled aluminum, is around $9 million. That I've never been quite sure what to call that, because it's not part of the redemption amount. It's
the residual the value benefit,
the
perhaps?
Can. It's, yeah, well, would you want to take that part also away from whoever now is getting it? And if so, what's your justification?
I don't, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, I don't think I necessarily would. I mean, that's the reason I called it out in my testimony, to point out the fact that to me, what we get is a lot of information in little vacuums about what costs are versus what money is coming into the system. I would argue that the more information that we have about it, about indeed how much this is costing, it is a system that has worked that, as I said, has encouraged innovation. And so I might argue that, great, let's work out a system whereby the co-op gets 2 cents handling fee on all of the containers. We split the unredeemed 50-50, and they get to keep the proceeds of the recycling. I'm not saying, you know, you are bad private business, you may not have this. I'm saying let's acknowledge the fact that there is a significant income stream that is being received beyond the cost of doing business. Or again, that is what I'm trying to even, I don't know if prove is the right word, or just discover. And that's without that whole additional revenue stream. So I'm trying to get clarity on the one side, and I would acknowledge that that's a whole other element that we could and probably should use in figuring out how to structure this going forward.
Thank you. Other questions?
Let's hear what the other side.
Are you proposing amendments?
I'm not. I don't think we have any yet, but we have just started conversations. This is a recent bill, and we started a recent conversation. I mean, I wouldn't move the bill today, but I don't think it's posted for a work session.
It is not posted, so we're not moving it today.
Yes. Okay.
All right.
Good to know. And could I? Do you want to comment on whether you have any? We have any specific? Just the equity issues that Rep. Power brought up to me in the conversation.
Well, and that's the reason I asked the question. Mm-hmm. The relating clause would appear to open it to amendments passed beyond the calculation issue, but I have no idea whether you have whether that's a part of what you intend or not.
Well, I'd like to hear. I know I've talked a little bit with the LBRC. I'd like to hear what they have to say today and continue conversations.
Sure, thank you. And that may not be a decision for today anyway. Thank you very much. Thank you. Very much appreciate your testimony. Let's hear from Jules Bailey and Marcia Kelly, please. Anyone else want to be heard on this bill today? Okay.
She and I have not been here for it. And that's good. How do we resolve it?
We're waiting for, Mr. Chair, we're waiting for something to come up on the screen, so if
Great.
Marcia would like
Marcia,
to go first.
Marcia, do you want to go ahead?
I'd rather wait and see what Mr. Bailey has to say.
Okay. Do you mind if I trade you places then so I can access the computer?
Yeah. All right.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, good to see you. My name is Jules Bailey. I am Chief Stewardship Officer for Oregon Beverage Recycling Cooperative. And if there's one thing I have, wonderful, thank you. If there's one thing I've been made assured of today, it's that Mazen has not lost his sense of humor since I've been gone. So it's good to be back in front of you again. I've missed it. I want to start by giving just a general overview because I think, despite the very strong overview that Vice Chair Smith Warner gave, maybe not everybody's on the same page around the bottle bill. So I hope you will indulge a quick bit of propaganda here. And I appreciate the timing of this committee because this Saturday is Earth Day, and we actually produced a video that is coinciding with Earth Day, and this will be the world premiere of our OBRC video. So you get to be the very first ones to see it.
All right, so our voluminous internet audience should understand they're privileged today to be the first recipient of this particular piece.
All two of them?
We were going to debut it during The Voice,
well,
but we actually
saved
it.
This is a worldwide broadcast, you realize.
Right. That's what I understand.
All right. Mr. Putin is watching.
I became the 33rd state in 1859. I like to think I look pretty good for my age. I possess some of the country's most stunning landscapes and as much natural beauty as any state could ask for. In all my time as a state, I've seen a lot of things change. And that's where you come in. It starts with a simple act of faith from somebody like you. And you. And you. Showing that you care about preserving my future. You've done incredible things within my borders, creating opportunities for all of my residents. But this modern life also creates waste. Lucky for me, you've found ways to manage this waste. Every day, I see you enjoying all that I have to offer. But sometimes you get distracted by my beauty, and you forget, just for a moment, how fragile I really am. My lakes, rivers, forests, deserts, mountains, and ocean beaches need to be protected. This requires coordination around the state to get recyclable materials to the right place. And it's something anyone can do. You are here to show your children the richness of this world so that they too will cherish it, ensuring a beautiful planet for future generations. I'm so grateful for the ways you keep me healthy and clean, engineering solutions with science and technology to protect my environment. And thanks to you, all those empty bottles that were once lost in my wilderness can be recycled into something you all can use again and again. Thank you for keeping me clean for all of your children and grandchildren. And the next time you reach for a bottle of something refreshing, don't forget to return it to your local bottle drop center.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the opportunity to show that here today. You've also got a PowerPoint in front of you that gives a little bit more information about the bottle bill and Oregon Beverage Recycling Cooperative. However, I believe about half of you are on the Energy and Environment Committee and already heard me go through that PowerPoint, so I will save you going through that PowerPoint again. A couple of points I'd like to bring up in relation to House Bill 3443. It's a little bit difficult to testify on this bill because I think, as you heard in the opening testimony, I'm not entirely sure what this bill is. There's the bill as written, and then there's the testimony that we heard about, I think, what some of the ultimate intentions might be or could be in the future. And I want to say at the outset that I very much understand the need for transparency, the desire for the public to get their arms around what's happening within the bottle bill and redemption system. And I want to offer my commitment that OBRC is committed to working with the legislature and with the public to figure out how we have appropriate transparency going forward that makes you all feel comfortable that you understand the system and that you're able to evaluate it well. We've seen a lot of changes in the system. We talked a little bit about the increase to 10 cents, and we are now at a point with the 10 cents that we've seen incredible volume coming in, and that's great. It's been refreshing to see Oregonians engaging with their bottle bill, redeeming and bottle dropping their empties. And if you were to project the numbers that we've seen thus far since the 10 cents forward, we'd be at a 93% redemption rate. And what we've seen is overwhelming demand that has meant that we've had to move very quickly. Not only are we rolling out bottle drops and our Bottle Drop Express program, which you can see in there, which is a new innovation, but we've also had a lot of orders coming in for new reverse vending machines at grocery stores, folks that want to get their arms around it. We can handle all of that volume, but it takes a lot of work and the ability to move very quickly to be able to do that. And there's a lot of cost in it as well. As you might imagine, there was a number of people who chose to save their bottles and cans that they'd paid a nickel for and redeem that at 10 cents, which was completely within the law, but we were responsible for refunding that extra nickel to everybody through the beverage industry, and we did so. We were happy to do it, but that's millions and millions of dollars out the door from that program. Let me talk a little bit first about the specifics of House Bill 3443, and then I want to talk a little bit about the discussion that we had or that I heard subsequent to that. 3443, I think, seeks to get its arms around that transparency issue by compelling the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to publish data on its website about the number of containers sold disaggregated by distributor in the state of Oregon. I'm a little unclear as to why disaggregated information is necessary to achieve the public purpose that I think is behind House Bill 3443, and I think could seriously jeopardize competitive information that distributors have, as you might imagine. It's a pretty cutthroat business. Columbia and Miletus do not always get along, Anheuser-Busch and others. Coke and Pepsi, a little bit of dogs and cats. But they do work together through Oregon Beverage Recycling Cooperative to make the bottle bill function, and jeopardizing some of that competitive and proprietary information would be a step that would really put some of our members' business practices in jeopardy and I think destabilize the bottle bill. But to the larger point then, all right, so if we're not doing disaggregated information, does it make sense to put aggregated information about total containers sold on the OLCC website? That information, as Representative Smith Warner noted, and as I think several people here noted, is already available and is collected by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. And it's information that we are happy to share and that the press already has access to, both the total number of containers sold and the redemption rate. Where we've decided to go, and in fact, we you may not believe us, but we started this before this bill came out, we've decided that as we go to 10 cents, we have even more responsibility for putting this kind of information in front of the public to make sure that they understand what's happening within the bottle bill. And so we've begun developing a quarterly reporting template that we could have on our website that would be easily downloadable, that would have a lot of the information that you're looking for. Now, I want to say very clearly for the record, for any reporter that's listening, the numbers that are here in this draft outline template are not actual numbers. They are ballpark accurate, but these are not God's honest truth numbers because we were scrambling to put together a template and work on it. But what we've looked at doing is a template that would include key information about employees, but overall budget, which we're happy to share, number of containers redeemed, most likely on the annualized basis that we report to Oregon Liquor Control Commission, breaking it down. We also are able to provide that information by bottle drop facility, so you get a sense of geographic spread around the state in our different zones. We really want to do a heat map because I think you'd find it very interesting about where people are redeeming. You see a lot of redemptions actually in Central Oregon is a very popular area for redemption. In fact, our number one bottle drop give fundraiser is the Redmond Humane Society. They do about 1.3 million containers a year. It's a big operation. We can show graphs of container return volume over time. talk a little bit about number of stores we have with reverse vending machines, bottle drops, ones under development, bottle drop express sites, number of green bag account holders, and not only the annualized redemption rate, but also the percent that's returned through bottle drop versus other means, which is an important metric for the OLCC as well. Talk about our bottle drop give program, the number of fundraisers, and then our partner organization, how much PET we're producing and others. Now, I understand this is a very high-level thing. This is just a template, and we're very much open to discussions about how we make this work in a way that the legislature would find compelling and that we think the public would find compelling, and we would offer that we would work with you over the interim to figure that out, especially given the lateness of the session. But I think to get a little farther down the road here on this, I think we have to be careful about putting just raw numbers up on an OLCC website that don't have any context or interpretation around them. And I think that's how we get to misunderstandings. Representative Smith Warner is actually quite good at math. I'm sure you're good at helping your daughter out. That number around $29-30 million of unredeemed is actually that's a number that we've openly said, I think, in public settings and our stand behind, although that's changing dramatically. We have a running joke around OBRC that you have to call in and check the bank account before you fill up the company car with gas, because we're a little short after handing out a lot of extra nickels over the last few weeks. But there's a much more to the business than just what is unredeemed. There's obviously Vice Chair Bence brought up the salvage value. There's a lot that's happening there. There's fees that are paid by distributors. We run trucks to 2,600 stores around the state. We have 5 plants, 300 employees. We have over a $34 million budget at Oregon Beverage Recycling Cooperative. It's a big organization. And so as we start to think about how we have processes that allow people to feel comfortable with what's happening in the bottle bill, keep in mind that in the legislature, you have whole committees at Legislative Fiscal Office and Ways and Means and all that devoted to looking into state agencies. Is that what we're talking about here, or are we talking about a number that lives on a website that may or may not be interpreted correctly? And I think we run the risk of getting to a slippery slope of something that is much more like this very intrusive oversight into what is essentially a privately run operation that I'm not sure the public really wants to get into every last detail of. Imagine, for example, we have a lot of situations where, as you might imagine, somebody has a dispute over how many cans were in a bag or a bag that was dropped off or something like that. We had a gentleman the other day who claimed that he had dropped off 7 bottle drop green bags through our interior door in Eugene, which doesn't have a scanner on it, and that we hadn't counted them. Well, we had no record of those bags coming through. He was unhappy about it. And we just said, hey, customer's always right. Here's the value of 7 bags on average. We'll just put on your account. You know, no questions asked. We'll just make it right for you. And is that the kind of decision that we would then be responsible for coming back and justifying the legislature? If we were doing Bottle Drop Express, we're working very quickly to try to put Bottle Drop Express out there, which is an innovative program that hasn't been discussed by the legislature, but we think is a really important thing to do and requires investments in rural Oregon and around the state. Is that the kind of thing that we would have to then justify the cost of every Bottle Drop Express box back to the legislature? Or our refillable beer bottle program that we're starting. We're now offering a program piloting with Double Mountain Brewery and soon open to others where we will wash and return bottles back to a brewery. Again, we think this is really good for the state. It's something that's not mentioned in the bottle bill. We think it's a really good thing for the environment. We can save a lot of money for breweries. Do we have to come back and justify those expenditures to the legislature? The answer to those may or may not be yes, but it's clearly a very large system and a lot of work to get your arms around what's happening here. So again, the offer that we would make is we would like to work on our quarterly reporting template, see if that gets you the information that you're looking for, allow us to do this and to work with you over the interim. And if it's not there, we can come back and do it. And that also has timing implications as well. We've gone through several major shifts in the bottle bill, both of the 10 cents and the container expansion that's coming up. You have a letter in front of you that's co-signed, a letter of concern by Oregon Environmental Council, AOI, OBA, Association of Oregon Recyclers, that are asking that we not make major changes like this through while we're at a very critical time in the bottle bill. And I think that speaks to the success that we've had working at the intersection of business and the environment. And then finally, the bill isn't about this, but I want to address some of the discussion that we had around unredeemed tax versus not tax. And I guess I would just, because the bill is not about that, I don't want to go into a whole lot of depth on it, but I want to put out a couple of points for your consideration on it, just to make sure that it's all on the table. The bottle bill deposit is a deposit. It's not a tax. And I think the important distinction there is you can't go and ask for your income tax back if you decide you want it back. We want people to redeem their bottles and cans. We want them to redeem their bottles and cans and to claim their deposit. And I think we get into some really troubling areas where if the public is relying on deposit money to, say, fund the EITC or employment-related daycare or public schools, that every time somebody finishes their bottle and can, if they are taking 10 cents out of employment-related daycare when they come and redeem their bottle and can, I think that sends a very dangerous precedence. And I think it also sets a dangerous precedence to put the state in the position of having a strong public disincentive on redemption and recycling to keep people from returning their bottles and cans because we don't want to somehow take money away from programs. So I think there's a lot of unanswered questions here. And the fact is, Vice Chair Smith Warner is absolutely right. Seven other states do it differently. And we receive calls from them every single day about how they can change to our system. And we're actually a real national model. We're proud of what we've done. And the California Legislature Assembly right now is moving a bill through the process that would actually change California to more of a model like Oregon has because it's worked well. So in summary, we appreciate the legislative intent behind this bill, behind 3443. Our commitment is to work with you on this, but we don't feel at this time that that it is appropriate to have a disruptive bill to a system that's in flux already, and we would ask that we work together on getting to where you want to go.
Thank you. Marcia.
Chair Barnhart. Vice Chair Benson, Vice Chair Smith Warner. My name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. I'm in favor of transparency, and so this bill goes toward that. And in order to figure out what I was really talking about, I started looking into the Oregon Beverage Recycler Scheme and where they might, when they collect the bottles, get rid of the bottles, and discovered that there was a place in St. Helens that chops the bottles all up. They happen to be a partner in that location. And one of the concerns that I have is that while they have redeemed money in their bank account, the Orpet plant is having an enterprise zone tax abatement to the tune of $106,000 in Columbia County. They also received Connect Oregon money through the Port of St. Helens to get a rail spur to the Orpet site, is what it's located. So I think that there are many reasons for more transparency when we're trying to partner for a good cause, but we may be being more generous than necessary in how the money that is not redeemed is spent, or in the case of not paying property taxes, not spent.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Johnson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jules, I guess I would just take a little exception to the statement I see in the document you submit, and I think you made it verbally too, but the question is, how is simply container disclosure going to jeopardize the bottle bill?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, that's a great question. I think the challenge here is that you've got a system where beverage distributors have voluntarily come together to create something and to invest in something that even goes beyond the letter of the law, right? Bottle Drop Express is not in the law. The refillable program is not there. They're making a lot of investments and spending their own money and making decisions like, we're going to choose to pay out a lot of nickels that weren't put in there as deposits in order to make sure that the system functions going forward. Putting disaggregated, as this bill would do, disaggregated distributor information on the website, jeopardizes the ability for the private sector to be able to do its private business that is outside of the bottle bill. Beverage distributors do more than run OBRC, where actually not a very big part of what they do. And then secondly, I think it creates the opportunity for a lot of misinformation and misunderstanding that's out there. You've seen reporters or articles that have talked about this that just throw out numbers like, here's the amount of unredeems that are out there, but there's no context in that article about, well, what is OBRC's budget? How many reverse vending machines did we need to buy? How many new bottle drop centers are we opening? What are all those things that happen? Because as you might imagine, this isn't a system that pays for itself just off of scrap value or whatever. Otherwise, every state would be doing this. And it's not a system that receives any taxpayer money at all, but I think might be in jeopardy of needing that someday in the future if there wasn't that that ability to do it. So I think having a bill that puts a shot across the bow of industry at a time when we're asking them to step up and make the kinds of investments that will keep the bottle bill functioning is destabilizing to the program.
Yep. Follow up?
I hadn't thought about it in terms of this before, prior to Rep. Smith Warner's testimony today regarding the redemption or the deposit being a tax. But when you look at it through the eyes of Oregonians who don't have equal access to bottle drop and or redemption centers, who are being charged at the cash register the redemption value of whatever container, we all know that's going to expand exponentially on January 1st. But all Oregonians do not have equal access to the facilities to enable them to conveniently get that back. That's what really concerns me, and it concerns my constituents, and because we have an uneven playing field right now. Yes, there are folks in the metro area that can put their bottles in there, and I think it's a wonderful program. It's great. Put their containers in the bag, drop the bag, it gets counted, you get the money in here, however you get it back. But for the rest of those Oregonians, they'd have to go to their neighborhood retailer and wait in line after work or on a weekend and make that investment of time to try to get their money back. I think for them it really is a tax, because they aren't getting a return on that investment. And it's very difficult for Oregonians to understand, especially when it goes from a nickel to a dime, why they shouldn't have access to this. But when they see OBRC, and I don't agree, again, I think these are wonderful programs on the bottle wash program, the recycle program, but why is OBRC investing in these programs before they guarantee equal access for Oregonians across the state? That's what I hear from my constituents.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Johnson, appreciate the sentiment, and that's why our large investment is in Bottle Drop Express, and we're opening at Safeway and Rose Hours in your district this year, and we have 12 locations coming around the state. But I want to correct a couple of things that I think sometimes get lost in the discussion. One, Bottle Drop is incredibly important, and we are expanding Bottle Drop and Bottle Drop Express because we want to have access to more areas. But there are 2,600 locations around the state of Oregon where you can redeem your bottles and cans at grocery stores, and that's why we send a truck to Hebo Market in Hebo, Oregon, because they do a fair number of bottles and cans that we can pick them up from that are where people are redeeming. The other part of it too is that I think it's really important that we understand that Bottle Drop is actually and Bottle Drop Express has been remarkably successful in areas outside of Portland as well. So, for example, Albany, I just looked these numbers up because I had a call from a reporter from the Albany Democrat Herald. asking me about numbers at the Albany bottle drop. We were averaging about 400,000 cans a week at the Albany bottle drop before the 10-cent change. We're now averaging over 800,000 cans a week at the Albany bottle drop. Our Klamath Falls bottle drop is through the roof. Our Grants Pass bottle drop is through the roof. So actually one of the areas where we have a challenge is in my neighborhood in urban Portland, and in Representative Smith Warner and Representative Powers' neighborhoods in urban Portland, because as you might imagine, and Representative knows, it's very expensive to get land in central urban Portland and to be able to site a bottle drop facility there, and there's also a lot of density considerations. That's one of the reasons why Bottle Drop Express is going to be important for an urban area as well. But we have bottle drop facilities around the state. We're not quite in every corner of the state, but when you look at the distribution with population, there's a reason that now we're at 60% of all returns in the state of Oregon go through a bottle drop facility, which was what the OLCC had targeted.
Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I read the quote earlier today as I was preparing for this hearing about it's not really a tax because you get your money back. But upon reflection, I realized that wasn't true. And the reason is you'll only get it back for like a second because you're then going to buy another case of beer. And so really, you never get your money back because you promptly go get something more that requires the same deposit. Mm-hmm. So to suggest it comes back is incorrect. It's a tax. It's just disguised as something different. But that's just a comment. What I really need your thinking on, and I mean it, is when government chooses to get involved in these systems, whether it's this one or the low carbon fuel standard comes to mind for some odd reason.
I'm not familiar with that program.
When it decides to get into these,
not
these,
germane.
and call them not government, not taxes, or not something. What duty do we, having created these, I almost said monsters, things, what duty do we owe the people of Oregon to try to protect them? If we saw, perish the thought, that your organization was making it 500% profit, but so what? We put 10-cent price on the bottle, and they're bringing it back. It's not littering the road anymore. Is it our business that we should worry that you're making a 500% profit? Why bother? I mean, we're getting the can away from the side of the road. We have, as a government, have done our job, or not. That's my question to you. Do we deserve to be, you know, wallowing around in this situation, having created it, or can we just get out and watch? Yeah.
And I would simply note, we have one more hearing to do today, about 15 minutes to do it. And so while this is a very interesting philosophical conversation, if you have a very short response, I'll take it.
The short response is, Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Smith, the legislature may wallow in anywhere it chooses to. But let me just address the comment very briefly, and then I'll address the question briefly. Vice Chair Benz, you have a wonderful mind at math, and so you'll understand when I say that, I think your comment about the tax is music to the grocery industry's ears. We hope people are going in and shopping and buying more. But B, that if that was the case, then it would be a lifetime, one-time 10-cent tax, because then you would get it back. So every time, but that said, to your question, Representative Vice Chair Benz, I think that Oregon Beverage Recycling Cooperative and the industry believe that transparency is important. And so I hear your point about, well, if the bottle is off the side of the road or it's getting recycled, is that just the end of the deal? And we believe that transparency is important, and that's why we have been working on this quarterly reporting format, because we do want people to be able to see what's happening within the system. But we want to do it in a way that's contextualized, and we want to do it in a way that protects proprietary information and that gives people the resources to understand what's going on. And we want to work with you on that. So we would not be ones to say, let's just wash our hands of it and walk away. We want to work together on it.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you. And thank you, Jules. You and I have talked about this before. I'm sure we will continue to, and I appreciate the perspective that you and the co-op bring very much. So I just want to throw out, you mentioned in passing in your thing that you guys have a $34 million budget every year, the OBRC does. So you are funded by unredeemed bottle deposits and fees from your members, and that's... and revenues from the recycling. Is that correct?
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Smith, we are funded by fees from members. We supplement with unredeemed deposits. We distribute – it's complicated, but we distribute salvage value back to members of the cooperative sort of based on what types of containers they put in. And there's a whole formula for that. But we do receive fees from our members to run the cooperative. But I should also mention that the costs that we're seeing in the system are going up. There isn't a linear relationship between the amount of redemption and the amount of cost as we are getting to higher redemption rates. In addition to there being less unredeemed deposits in the system, we have to get more equipment out there. We got to run more trucks. We got to do a bunch of stuff. So our costs per bottle go up essentially to maintain a larger system that can get to every corner of Oregon, to Representative Johnson's point. So costs are increasing as well.
Thank you. Okay.
Is it okay?
Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair. Perhaps a quick question. How do you resolve internally the tension between investing in the system and generating profits for members?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Marsh, we are a not-for-profit cooperative, and we reinvest back into the system because the system isn't where it needs to be yet. So we reinvest our unredeemed deposits back in building out the system, which is sort of that nice spring-loaded system that's built into the bottle bill. If redemption rates fall, there's more unredeemed deposits to be able to invest in the system to bring redemption rates up. If redemption rates are up, then there's less unredeemed deposits and less and more efficiency in the system. So that's where we get a lot of the money, not all, but a lot of the money to have 6 bottle drops in process right now as we speak, 12 bottle drop expresses and others. And that's entirely where our focus is investing in the system.
So all money is reinvested in the system? None of it goes to members of the co-op?
Right now, we are investing unredeemed deposits back into the system.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Look, I have a quick comment, and I'm going to close the hearing. The quick comment is, it seems to me, given the conversation that we've had on this bill today, there may be a place where a sweet spot somewhere. I think the legislature's needs, and I'm not certain that I certainly don't speak for Representative Smith Warner, but I think the legislature's needs is to understand better how the system actually works and what the finances, how the actual finances are. I think that it's far less likely that we actually need to know the information that you're calling proprietary information of the members. I may be wrong about that, but I suspect that that's true. And it would be, I think it would be useful if the co-op and the sponsors of the bill were willing to have a conversation about what amendments might be done that would accomplish both of our goals. And I'm getting head nods, and I appreciate that. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3443 and open the public hearing on House Bill 3435. Is that yours also?
Yes.
Please.
No.
Yeah.
Joking,
yeah.
Mr. Chair, this bill, as you see, the bill is short in text. However, the bill, what it basically attempts to do is to allow for the counties to loan money to other taxing districts. And that money is specified to be the road fund money. Now, we just for reference of what we've done in the past, I have in your background what usually have been done through many legislative session using the ONC or federal funds and the safety net money. And how these were loaned or used by different purposes for the counties or the county law enforcement and so on.
Is that in the SMS or somewhere else?
Yes, that is in the SMS. That's the background is in SMS. However, this does not necessarily address the same issue. This addresses primarily the road fund in general, but and the road fund, of course, as you know, some of the road fund money comes from
state fees and taxes, and those state fees and taxes are usually governed by your highway fund restrictions, Article 9 in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. So this primarily says that these funds would be available for loans and restricts these loans with type of restrictions that you would have from line 13, subsection big A through D, and says what the length of the loan and what the conditions of those loans are, and therefore the idea, I think, that it is not spending the money somewhere besides what is constitutionally required, but it is loaning the money.
It does eventually return to the road fund. Right. Representative, thank you very much for waiting through that interesting model bill. Please go ahead.
Legislative staff pretty much took care of the testimony that I needed to take care of today. So,
do we have a sign-up list?
Mr. Chair, committee members, David Brock Smith, State Representative, House District 1, Charleston, California border, over to West Cave Junction, back up to West Roseburg, back over to Charleston. And I believe Representative Johnson, Mr. Chair, we had this to the bottle bill issue before. The expansion into the drop sites.
Yeah, but let's stick with this bill now.
I understand.
If you would.
No problem, other than I don't believe that there'll be one in my district, unfortunately. So 3435 is a tool to be used by our counties. I just want to start up front that there will be amendments coming that will narrow the bill to a few counties. Unintended consequences for this, you know, tool was some counties don't want the line at the door, so to speak, that to allow this to happen. So as staff mentioned, this bill allows us to utilize road funds as a loan only to special taxing districts within the county. And then there's sideboards in the bill, as you can see, that would allow the loan not to exceed 20 years of the special district's taxes that are collected by the county with interest, and that the county must put up at minimal collateral those taxes to be collected. It has in no way does it compare to the other ONC bill, if you will, that allows road funds to be used for to fund the direct and indirect cost of patrol. They're complete opposite concepts. This actually is really intended for counties to help themselves, if you will, and the other special districts within the county. So I'll use some examples. The port of Brookings Harbor has about $5.5 million in IFA loans at an upwards of 5.5-6%. This is one way where the county of Curry, that has roughly $30 million in its road fund, could pay off that note, if you will, for the Port of Brookings Harbor at a much lower interest rate. Reason being, currently those dollars and the dollars in other road funds in other counties are invested mostly in the local government investment pool, only collecting between 0.5% to 1% interest. This would allow counties to invest in themselves, if you will, secured with those tax dollars that the counties already collect. And at minimum, and then be able to increase the revenue through the interest coming into the road department, the road reserve fund, and then also in the example of the Port of Brookings Harbor, they would be lowering their interest payments and can take that, those saved dollars, and invest into their own working capital and themselves.
It's a simple fix. We're going to narrow it down again with amendments to a limited number of counties, and we might come back to you in future sessions to expand those counties if they choose to take advantage and have that line at the door. I think the sideboards that are in the bill are good. Again, the commissioners of the county would be the ones that would be negotiating this this agreement. Again, the loans are only to the special taxing districts within the county, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? For Representative Brock Smith. So you'll bring it, the amendment that you want, and let us know.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We don't have any other witnesses to testify with this bill, and I appreciate your time this afternoon. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3435. And committee, we are meeting tomorrow at 1 o'clock. We will meet for less than an hour so that we can get to the floor at 2. It was announced by the Speaker Pro Tem today that we're meeting, and of course the adjournment was to 11. So I'm assuming we're having the normal morning session. And then we're going to we'll recess and then reconvene at 2 o'clock. So this committee will have 1 hour to work tomorrow, and we'll have some of our work sessions that we've scheduled for tomorrow, and the rest of them, whatever we don't get to, we'll carry over till Monday. All right? With that, the committee's adjourned.